My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
Come, come, come and make eyes at me down at the old woolen bush. Come, come, have some port wine with me down at the old woolen bush. Hear the little German band. Just let me hold your hand, dear. Do, do. Come and have a drink or two down at the old woolen bush.
Hi, Kate. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
Women at War special. Let's talk about fighting on the home front and the legacy of women and World War One. You take examples from women from all walks of life, nurses, land girls, and those that even cleaned trains. What sort of roles, you know, opportunities did women have in the First World War?
Well, life opened up for them in a way that I think they had never imagined, because before the war started, middle-class women, for example, very, very rarely worked. They were people who were involved in the home, in being housewives, and it was considered wrong that they should go out to work if they were married, and they were barred from many of the professions. And for working-class women, most of the time what you had was a huge amount of women who were in domestic service. And in a way, the government didn't even think that was real work, because it was cleaning.
Oh,
and they
God.
Hardly counted in the statistics. But what happened from the very start of the war was the realization, with such huge numbers of men joining up, volunteering to go off to fight, that all kinds of jobs were going to be vacant. You had so many men going off from small businesses, because every single person shopped in those days in little shops up and down the high streets everywhere. There were very few chains or big department stores. So men had gone from that. And they were some of the first jobs that women took up. It doesn't seem odd to us today, but in 1914, people went, good heaven, there's a woman running the bakery. It was, you know, just different. And then by the time the whole war machine got going, what you had was vast numbers of women going into engineering, heavy industry, the steelworks, into the shipyards, and the largest number are going to make munitions, bombs and shells and bullets. And so they really covered the waterfront in a way. They did so many different sorts of jobs.
Well, the thing is that women don't even generally do those heavy duty jobs now. So that must have been so radical then.
Hugely so. It occasioned outraged letters to the newspapers,
yes,
people grumping on about things,
yeah,
and the terrible changes that were happening. By no means was all of this welcomed by both men and women, because it was such a challenge to convention. There were women delivering the post. And I think that's a good example of the kind of prejudice before the war, because it was considered that women probably couldn't remember more than their own address.
So they really thought that women had a smaller mind then?
They thought that women couldn't take responsibility, couldn't learn skills, and would be very, very subject easily to any kind of stress. They thought that women were mentally and emotionally weaker. Never mind the physical arguments. They thought that too much thinking would possibly do terrible things to their brain.
It's so hard for us to imagine this, isn't it? I mean, it is just really shocking.
Absolutely. You put your finger on it. I mean, it's very difficult to explain to young people today that 100 years ago, life was almost like on another planet. There was so much tradition, convention, and restriction on what women could do. And that was the case whether you were rich or poor.
Yes, that's
very,
what's interesting.
Very,
yeah,
narrow kind of existence,
yes,
for most. Of course, there are always the amazing exceptions and the lady explorers in Victorian times and the outstanding individuals. But for the vast majority of women, life was so very different to our lives today. It's very hard to imagine it.
Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime. Were the women in your family involved in the First World War then?
Looking back, everybody was pretty well drawn into it, whether they liked it or not. Women weren't compelled to work. There was no order from the government for them to do so. But for a lot of work, a lot of women, they found themselves sort of, as it were, doing extra. In my hometown, where I was brought up in my adopted family, there's no doubt whatsoever that the grandmothers certainly had extra work to do. They didn't go into munitions plants. They were middle-class ladies. But mm-hmm. what they were hugely involved in was raising money for every single kind of voluntary activity, such as the nursing assistants, the VADs going to France, the Red Cross, and comforts for the troops and all of this. They were busy day and night raising money, holding bring and buy sales, concerts, organizing fairs, collecting on special, you know, collecting days with their tins. That's the first time that sort of thing happened. Yeah. And there they were, absolutely flat out, as it were, in their bit of the war effort.
This must have stimulated women and totally and really got them going for the first time in centuries.
Well, hard to tell about that sort of thing. Mm. Obviously, some women felt that it was a great opportunity, especially those who'd been involved in the suffrage movement.
Yes.
Campaigning for 10 years before the war for the vote. They were very alert and aware that opportunities were arising and that they could show what they could do. For other women, there was undoubtedly the lure for nearly a million of them who went into the munitions factories of higher pay.
Yes.
Those who'd been skivvies and cook's assistants and parlour maids were offered three times their domestic servants' wages to go into the factories. Even though it was only half what a man earned for the same job, for them, it was riches. They were amazed. It was a fantastic opportunity because there were very, very few ways women could earn a decent wage. Automatically, they always earned less than men, whatever they were doing.
So that means that's why the attitude changed after the First World War. People just didn't want to be servants anymore. That was what changed it.
Oh, the famous cry of the servant problem that went up during the war, not just after it, as women who had large houses, for example, and needed lots of servants to make the fire and carry the buckets of coal and carry up hot water to bedrooms upstairs, never mind clean the place and cook. They lamented during the war that their servants had skittered off to the munitions plants and the factories. And after the war, some women, by sheer necessity, having lost their wartime jobs, had to go back to service. But a very large number vowed never to do so. And the servant problem was something which one heard for decades after.
Yes.
With people saying, you can't get the help, you know.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah. What I'm interested in is also they probably got the freedom that they could go to pubs, drink, be friends with other women, you know, be more equal, you know, I mean, it must have...
To a point. I think there were certainly new freedoms, new experiences, particularly for working class girls and middle class, because when some of them went off to work, and if they went off to work in the big factories, or they got a job in a nearby town, young unmarried girls in those days never left home until they got married.
Oh,
and they didn't go and live elsewhere. There were no flats or digs or, you know, rooms for them, never mind getting their own place. You stayed at home under your dad's thumb, very much so. And it was a complete sort of gust of freedom that they experienced when they found that after a day's work, you know, away in the town and away from the home, gosh, they could possibly go out with the girls.
Yes, no,
it was something very new. I don't think we should imagine that there was a revolution, that everybody suddenly changed. I mean, I can remember there were decades, right up until the 40s and 50s, where Victorian sort of fathers and heads of families complained when their daughters wore makeup and wouldn't let them go to a pub.
Yes.
What it was a taste of independence. They could do it. It might happen. But it certainly didn't, as it were, usher in a whole new era immediately. It was gradual.
I mean, I suppose, actually, then everyone went wild in the 20s, and the 30s was a depression. I suppose the 40s was the next war, was the next time women got a taste for freedom again.
Well, they did, again, almost exactly what they were doing in the First World War, taking on men's jobs and particularly going into munitions. And there wasn't a huge advance forwards, because they still weren't allowed really anywhere near the armed services, except in menial positions, you know, as cooks and cleaners and typists. There was no suggestion that they played any other great role in World War II. So really, we're having to wait until the 60s before the huge changes begin to take place. And a great number of women, right into the 60s, were fired from their jobs when they got married.
Gosh. Well, I still know people that have been fired from their jobs when they've had a baby, I must say. I mean, in a subtle way it's happened, you know. Suddenly
I think you've actually highlighted the fact, the kind of overt, obvious discrimination against women, which a lot of people would, there's no doubt, still quite like to practice, is now more carefully covered up. It's more subtle, but it is still there. We are by no means in full equality yet.
No, definitely, especially with the thing that we haven't got equal pay yet as well, have we?
Indeed. When I was researching the whole business of pay and women earning so much less than men in World War One, I came across the simple description for the reason for it, which was you were paid not for what you did, but for who you were.
God, that's mind-blowingly terrible.
Yes. And that was the whole philosophy behind unequal pay.
RadioGorgeous.com. So you were the first kind of, well, you are the first famous war reporter in the UK, definitely.
Well, there were, and I would hate to sort of claim that, because there were women who reported for the BBC in the Second World War.
Yes.
So I wouldn't, admittedly, I got my chance very much in television, which really only began to come to the fore in the 60s. So maybe in telly there was some pioneering work. I'd never dare call myself the first.
But you were on the front line first.
Well, there is no such front thing in most wars as a front line these days. War is random amongst the people, civil war, insurgency. I think the better description is in the thick of it. Because you can really never. I did 4 years, for example, in former Yugoslavia in the 90s, and I don't think any of us ever found a front line yet.
Gosh, I think that's even more scary. Now, I'd like to know about fear. Do you feel fear, or do you so focused on your job that you don't?
Oh, no, I mean, everybody who goes anywhere near a real war gets terrified. It's nothing like the movies. The reality of war is absolutely heart-stoppingly frightening, terrifying.
So how do you deal with it?
Well, you don't actually concentrate on dealing with it. If you've got a job to do, if you have as a journalist, then you do have an enormous amount of things occupying yourself. I was working in television. I'm responsible for keeping a cameraman out of trouble and out of harm's way, and he's got one eye closed and is staring through the lens and can't see what's happening behind him or beside him. So you're concentrating, you're looking, you know, to avoid harm and really getting into the sort of trouble which is going to be lethal. You are also trying to take in everything that's happening around you, find things out, under the worst of circumstances, when people are distraught, hysterical, or enraged, or almost pathologically violent. So you've got a lot of things to think about. And on the whole, that helps. You're quite right. It helps. And you have a lot to do. So you don't have sort of long periods to sit and think, God, this is absolutely terrifying. Gosh, what? You're so busy, intensely busy, that that helps keep your mind on the job, as it were. But there are some terrible moments, and particularly if you're under fire, it can be absolutely terrifying.
You can rely on Radio Gorgeous. You've been involved with many different wars, the embassy siege, Tiananmen Square, the Gulf War, to name a few. Which one has affected you personally the most?
Oh, I can't think of it in those terms.
Right. You are that cut off, in a way.
I've always felt very strongly that you take each story as it comes, and they're all very different as well. They're different atmospheres, different things happen in front of you, and your own circumstances can be very different. So, I mean, I would just sort of think, what do you specifically remember? I suppose I still remember the night when the Chinese army came in and murdered its own people.
God.
Which was in its own capital, which was truly, truly horrific.
Terrible, terrible. So you obviously have the qualities to make a war reporter. What are they?
Oh, I don't think there are such things. And also, there are no such things as war reporters, per se. No advertiser job as war reporter. It comes with the turf. You report wars because, sadly, it's part of human experience. And wars can happen in the most beautiful countries or in the most run-down urban places. And you might find yourself reporting on violence and conflict. And there's such a huge variation. So I don't think it's a particularly different sort of reporting. You're looking to find out what happens. You're looking to make sure that it's accurate, that you can verify what people tell you as well. You're looking to see what the people on site, what their experience is. Yours is peripheral. You're just there to observe. But you want to hear from the people who are involved. And then on top of everything else, it being journalism, you've got to get the story out as fast as possible.
Yes.
So you do that, though, in any story. It only, put it this way, in war or conflict areas, it just tends to be a bit more difficult.
Now, I want to ask about radio, because you started off in radio and you still work on Radio 4. Is radio your love, would you say?
Oh, I mean, I think radio is the most tremendously flexible of mediums. It's something which you can do so much in. I wouldn't, though, totally reject the television in favour of radio. There are some times when you are immensely glad you have a camera to show things.
Yes.
Because, you know, the human eye reacts. And there are some sights which are unforgettable. And even if you describe them well in radio, it doesn't quite have the same impact. On the other hand, working in radio, the actual work is, again, much more flexible. There's just you and a little microphone.
Yeah.
If you're a reporter, you can nip around. It's speedy. It's intimate. It's not so intrusive as a camera. All of these things are an immense advantage. And then when you're in a studio as well, it's much less formal. Voices can chip in. You don't have to have the camera on you. Things are more fluid. Radio can do so much. And I remember starting in local radio, and here I am back again on radio.
Radio Gorgeous. Listen anywhere, anytime. Now, are you a pacifist?
I am not a signed-up pacifist to any particular kind of theory. I'm someone who has seen very much the determination of people to defend their home and family and themselves. And I think particularly this when you see women who have their families threatened by people who will not be open to negotiation, who will not, people who will stop at nothing. And you will see women, for example, defend their families to the last. And they would not be signed up pacifists. There is a strong sense in all of us of survival. I don't in any way like war, but there are times when you see that people should defend themselves against the unreasoned, you know, psychotic brutishness of some people bent on doing them ill.
Fascinating. So, and lastly, going back to your book, which story moved you most in when you were researching it and writing it?
There were individuals, I think, young women, very young women, who went to what was then extraordinarily foreign places in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe and endured extraordinary things. I think the tale that is the most surprising to a lot of people is that of Flora Sands, who was a 37-year-old vicar's daughter and who ended up fighting legitimately as a soldier in the First Serbian Army on the front line in the heat of the action. And it's an amazing tale. And she comes out of it so well. A jolly, charming, good-looking woman. And she just coped. And she did what she thought was the only thing to be done in very extreme circumstances.
Fascinating. Fighting on the Home Front, The Legacy of Women in World War One is published by Hodder and Stoughton. Thank you so much, Kate Adie, for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Come, come, come and make eyes at me down at the old woolen bush. Come, come, have some port wine with me down at the old woolen bush. Hear the little German band. Just let me hold your hand, dear. Do, come and have a drink or two down at the old woolen bush. Talk about the shade of the sheltering palm. Praise the bamboo tree with its wide-spreading charm. There's a little nook down near old Hampstead Town. You know the place, it has won great renown. Often with my sweetheart on a bright summer's day, to the little pub there my footsteps will stray. If she hesitates when she looks at the sign, promptly I whisper, now do not decline. But come, 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 come and make eyes at me down at the old woolen bush. With me down at the old woolen bush. Hear the little German band. Just let me hold your hand, dear. Do, do, come and have a drink or two down at the old